Good afternoon and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Zipperer, Vice President of Media and Editorial at the Commonwealth Club and your host for Week to Week, the news review program at the Commonwealth Club. We also welcome our listeners on the internet and everyone here in San Francisco and invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. I'm pleased to introduce our two panelists for today. For the first half hour is, right to my right, Deborah Saunders. She's a popular and, dare I say, controversial columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle, where she also writes the blog for sfgate.com called Token Conservative. You've probably also seen her as a guest on CNN's Reliable Sources program, and you certainly can find her on Twitter. What is your...
Deborah J. Saunders.
Deborah J. Saunders.
I want people to sign up today. am I not mic'd well
now
enough
you are.
Either? I'm okay?
Yep.
Okay.
And next to her is Dr. Larry Gersten, professor of political science at San Jose State University. You've also seen him as a regular political analyst on NBC 11. And he's the author of the upcoming book, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California, which will be out in April. Is it April or March?
Actually, March.
March, excuse me. And you can find him on Facebook. So later in our program, we will be bringing up on stage Michael Fox, movie critic, for an in-depth discussion about a little TV program this weekend. I think it's called the Academy Awards. You've probably heard of it. But let's get into our discussion of the week's events. In the 2008 presidential primaries, the Democrats seemed to have all the fun primary activity. There was that knockdown, drag-out competition between Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. This election cycle, all of the excitement seems to be on the Republican side, so let's start there. Deborah, a week or two ago, I would have asked you if the Republican primary is going to be all sewn up by the time it even comes to California. Now it's looking like it's going to be possibly still alive. What's your take on
that? I think it will be alive, and I think it will be very painful.
Painful?
Do you remember that scene in Jurassic Park when the guy's trying to steal the embryos for the dinosaurs and... And the little dinosaurs come after and they slit his abdomen open. And in the book, he's thinking, I just want this to be over now. Well, that's how some of us Republicans feel right now as we're watching what's going on. It's a pretty painful, long process.
Is it more painful for Mitt Romney supporters, or do you think the Rick Santorum folks are kind of enjoying it?
Well, I think that there are people who don't like... Now, I probably, if I had to vote tomorrow, I anticipate I'll be voting for Mitt Romney. And I'm not a big Mitt Romney fan, but he just seems like the best in the group. And he also seems to be the best Republican to beat Barack Obama. But I also care about governing. And I do think he would be the best in the group when it comes to governing. But it's pretty clear that the Republican electorate is not real happy about him because they can't coalesce around him and they keep looking at other candidates. Now, I want to mention that, you know, we're really only 2 months into the election. We've had a lot of polls. We've had a lot of events that happened. And things aren't as long as they certainly seem. It's also clear that people keep coalescing around the candidate who isn't Mitt Romney. And it's been Rick Santorum at times. It's been Newt Gingrich at times. And Ron Paul is going to be a factor in this race. He could be a factor all the way through. How many people here know a kid who voted for, under 30, because that's me, who voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and is now going to vote for Ron Paul? He is going to be a factor in this race, and if he decides that all the kids are going to write him in, he could end up being chosen by that group Americans Elect. I mean, all sorts of things could happen with him. This is going to be, I thought 2008 nothing could get better when I was at the conventions and it's all the things that you were watching happen. But you know, especially Sarah, you know, and when we're in the airport going from Denver to Minneapolis and we hear the name Sarah Palin, wow. But this year is going to be pretty amazing, too.
Larry, do California GOP voters, are they representative of GOP voters across the country, or are they different? Can we expect anything different when they get to make their choice?
I'll get to that, but I wanted to piggyback a little bit on what Deborah said. I think the thing about Ron Paul and Rick Santorum is that they both ooze authenticity. You know, nobody's perfect out there. We know that. But these guys have walked the walk. They've talked the talk. They've been relatively consistent on most things. And I think the problem for a lot of Republicans with Mitt Romney is that, you know, he's trying to fit into something, and he's just not very comfortable even doing it. I don't think he believes half of what he says. I really don't.
Half?
Yeah.
Maybe half.
I actually think, you know, looking at this analytically, I think he's by far the most prepared, and he's a problem solver. That's what impresses me about him. Unfortunately, all the good stuff about him never gets out there because he's trying so hard to be what he's not. And you know what? People see it. They see it. And that's why they have a hard time saddling up to this guy. And the Mormon thing doesn't help either. I mean, there's a lot of evangelicals out there who just refuse to view Mormons as you know, Christians. And in the Republican Party, especially in primaries, those folks come out disproportionately. To your question about California Republicans, it's not that California Republicans are so different, in my judgment, as much as there's more of the difference. So I think we've got basically two types of Republicans here. We've got the fiscal conservatives and the evangelical conservatives. A lot more evangelical conservatives than we think because we live in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, around here, evangelicals hide because, you know, there are not enough of them to come out and say, here I am. But you go down Central Valley, go down into Southern California, and there's an awful lot of evangelical conservatives. And they're going to be the Santorum types. They're going to be the folks, you know, who are going to really look to him. And by the way, you saw that latest field poll, 6 points. And Santorum gained, I think, about 20 points or 14 points in the last 10 days. In 10 days. Good grief. I think the other ones, the fiscal conservatives, are going to be more comfortable with Romney because, again, he's a problem solver. I think you're looking at a very close race. And to Deborah's point, yes, in large part because the Republicans have democratized the selection system. Okay, that is to say, Super Tuesday now is 10 states instead of 31. Spread it out. Spread the pain, sorry. And all the primaries from this point on are proportional. That is to say, you get 20% of the vote, you get somewhere around 20% of the delegates. And so that means guys like Gingrich and Paul can hang around forever and walk into the convention with pockets full of votes. So it could be for the first time in 60 years. That could be fun. Sorry.
No, actually, that would be fun. Yeah. That would be fun.
If it says the reporter in you.
Well, not only that, but it says a Republican in me, I have really? To say. It's pretty clear that these guys haven't set anybody on fire, you know. I tend to go against the conventional wisdom about a tough primary hurting the winner. I think that the tough primary helped Barack Obama. And I think tough primaries frequently turn somebody who isn't that well-known into a giant. It's just not happening this time around. You know, I have a lot of faith in Republican voters. In California in 2008, they set up the primary to hand it to Mitt Romney. And instead, California voters gave it to John McCain, and he was the candidate who was the best candidate. And I think the problem that Republicans are having this time around is they don't know who the best candidate is. They really haven't locked on the person who they think is most likely to win in November, and that's why they're flailing all around.
Yeah, and I'm not so sure, though, that this time is going to be like 2008, because let's remember, by Super Tuesday in 2008, it was done. McCain had won it. And so, sure, by that time, there's a whole snowballing. And yeah, the California voters went along with it. But I think this is, you said it early, this is painful. This is painful for Republicans. And I think this pain is going to go on. And I'm not sure. I think it's made Romney a better speaker, a better debater. I guess after 20 times, anybody gets better. But beyond that, there's so much animus. And, you know, I remember Democrats in 2008, they were torn because, the ones I know at least, said, gosh, I like them both. I like them both. I know families that were at war over this, okay? It wasn't that I hate this one, therefore I'm reluctantly going for that one. And that's what I see this time around.
Well, one of our audience members asked, is there still a chance then that the Republican nominee could be someone from outside, Mitch Daniels, Chris Christie, who could...
I mean...
No?
Karl Rove says no, and a lot of the people who look at the dates and the calendar, it just seems like it would be a very difficult thing to have happen, because this probably will be settled earlier than we think.
Right.
And it may well happen that by Super Tuesday we know who the winner is going to be, even if he has not gathered the delegates. So it's probably not going to happen, but you just don't know. I mean, one of the things I love about politics is you don't know what's going to happen. There are surprises that come out, things you never thought about that come out. So if Republicans are feeling this unhappy with their choices, it could happen.
Here's a little sliver of data that will tell a big story. In 2008, as the Democrats began, you know, biting their nails over this whole thing, and they weren't too happy that it was going on for so long, those in the know, call them the elites, call them the leaders, call them whatever word you want, were about 20% of the superdelegates, they were called. They're about 20% of the convention, 20%. And there was talk, you know, okay, we've got to throw our, you know, our collective vote someplace to break this up. As it turned out, Obama peeled them off as he began to build his momentum. The superdelegates for the Republicans this time are only 7%. So there is no big group who at the end can say, all right, boys and girls, get in the room, this is how we're going to do it. They are really less organized than the Democrats, and I didn't think anybody could be less organized than the Democrats. You know, it's amazing, you know. But this time, if there's ever going to be one, we're seeing the conditions, you know, that make it possible. That's kind of exciting.
When we talk about potential damage to the general nominee, the general campaign nominee, sometimes they're worried about the perception of the candidate. And I think I agree with the idea that certainly Obama came out a stronger debater. He was not a strong debater when he started. I wonder, though, if there's a different kind of damage, and that is, what about the money raise? I mean, can you only tap out your donors, whether they're rich or middle class, so many times, and then you go into what's going to be a very expensive general election campaign, I'm sure.
Well, I think it's really the capital of how much of goodwill that the Republicans are going to have to wear out. After 20 debates, people are sick of watching them and hearing them, a lot of them, mm-hmm. and they're tired. I think super PACs are going to take care of the money problem, oh. And that there's going to be just millions of dollars funneled into these things, keeping things going. The campaigns are going to have to pay for the planes, in the staff, in the organization, but there'll be outside organizations. There'll be outside Super PAC GOTV, Get Out the Vote, and there'll be, of course, outside ads. So I don't think there's going to be a shortage of money in this race.
There was a piece in yesterday's, I think, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, can't remember which, saying that Romney had actually tapped 65% of his donors could give him no more, you know, for the primaries. And the other guys, Santorum and Gingrich, were 10%, 12%, whatever it was. So you're quite right. In a sense, this whole money-raising thing since Citizens United is, you throw it away. Doesn't matter anymore. These people like Sheldon Adelson of $10 million to Gingrich, and the Koch brothers, $100 million they're talking about.
George Soros.
Yeah, Soros too. But I think most of the big money so far we've seen on the Republican side. Now,
that's
Obama just gave
that's,
right. Obama
that's
just gave permission the other day, yeah. Right? So we'll see how fast those pockets open up. You're right. Yeah. But what was talked about is $1 billion campaign for Obama alone this year. How many zeros are in a billion? You know. It'll be probably a $3 billion race when we're all done.
Yeah, I think you're right. Can I mention one other thing, and that's Meg Whitman? Because I think you can't get away from the 2010 California governor's race. I mean, you have to think about it when you look at Mitt Romney, because they're so similar, these two candidates. You know, Meg Whitman decided that she should get in there and that she had the money, and she chased Steve Poizner out. And you're seeing the same thing going on with Romney. There's a bit of a feeling of, I bought this race fair and square, and then I'm going to chase, and I've been campaigning long and hard, and I'm just going to chase the other guys out. And that worked for Meg Whitman for the primary, but people didn't go for that toward the end.
Right.
And you get a feel with both of them that you're not quite sure why they're doing this, and that's it's a problem. By the way, I have a column in Sunday's Chronicle on some of these issues.
Oh.
Well, let's actually move off politics for a bit, because speaking of your columns, you recently wrote something about the difficulty Oakland is having policing the Occupy movement. And something that I guess I've been interested in watching this unfold nationally and, of course, internationally, is that where you've seen these really violent, the encampments and the protests get really bad with, police overreaction and anarchist outbreaks, has not been in, like you might think they might be in, conservative bastions, really conservative cities. They've been in very, Oakland, Berkeley, New York City. What's going on?
Oakland opened its arms to Occupy Oakland. City Hall said, yeah, we want you here. And it's pretty clear that the Occupy Oakland people and the other Occupy City people have decided that if they go into liberal towns, people aren't going to treat them the way they treat other protesters. There's this guy named Walter Hoy. He's a pro-lifer who stood in front of reproductive clinics, reproductive health clinics, and with a sign that says, Jesus loves you, please have your baby. Oakland put him in jail and got him sentenced to 30 days in jail for doing that. He never, didn't block anybody, didn't stop access, didn't do anything. The Occupy Oakland people move into Frank Ogawa Plaza. They break the law by putting those tents there. They take over buildings. They do all of this stuff. And it took weeks before the city really did anything about it. And then, of course, as you recall, Scott Olson, an Iraq war vet, got hurt by a tear gas canister, and everybody jumped on Gene Kwan. Gene Kwan, who was one of the big Ebonics pushers in Oakland, all of a sudden has John Stewart and all these people from the left telling her how bad she is for letting this happen, and she invites Occupy Oakland back. It's like robbing an old lady, right? If you're a thief, you're going to rob an old lady because it's easier, and that's what Oakland is for the Occupy Oakland movement.
An interesting aspect of the whole Occupy movement, I think, is that the occupation itself is, if what you're trying to do is put pressure on, for example, financial institutions, is there a single banker who's been discomfited even by people sleeping overnight in a park? It's not like the investment bankers turning off their computer and their desks at the end of the day, grabbing their jacket and going and looking for a park bench to sleep on. Where is this stopping to be a movement and becoming more kind of public performance art?
Are you saying, John, you think this should be happening in a country club, for example, or
that would be interesting? But if that's their stated target,
mm-hmm. We could talk about Oakland or New York or Occupy Wall Street, but I think there's something here though that we have to sort of get past some of this, which is hard to do when you see people being hurt and whatnot. But whether it's the occupiers or the Tea Party types, I think there are strands that bring them together. They wouldn't want to be in the same room, that's for sure. But someplace, lots of people are feeling disaffected. Someplace, somehow, lots of people are feeling left out. Whether it's the occupiers or the Tea Partiers, they feel like they have been abandoned. And I just think that somehow we have to come to terms with this. Forget about, their tactics are terrible, on all ways around, on both sides. But it tells me something about their desperation. And I somehow think we don't often pay attention to that as much as we are. We got to keep these guys away. They're breaking the city hall. Yeah, of course, that's terrible stuff. But what's going on underneath here? What's the fundamental problem? Until we address those things, I think these things aren't about to go away.
The Czech economist, Tomáš Sedláček, I hope I pronounced that correctly, recently spoke here at the Commonwealth Club, and he said that the Occupy and the Tea Party movements both are kind of making the same mistake of giving economics too much, if you will, authority. One side sees the market, for example, as being the root of all evil. The other side is saying the markets will solve all of our problems. Of course, we also had a Republican candidate, Michelle Bachmann, on this stage, and she said that the difference is that the Tea Party cleans up after their protests. So now we know.
Good point.
Well, she's a laugh a minute. Let's talk about California politics. Governor Jerry Brown has a tax plan that he was going to put for, I guess, is he still putting it forward as a referendum, as an initiative?
Getting signatures.
And there are two other competing programs that are all kind of in the same realm of increasing taxes on the wealthier citizens. Let's start with Larry. What do you see as this, what could this result in? I mean,
I think there's a couple of things. First of all, the field poll just came out today. So maybe some of you have seen it in the Chronicle, among other places. It shows Brown's right now at 58%. The tax the millionaire proposals by the California Teachers Association at 63%. The third one is not doing so well. I think there's a problem. I don't care how many times people say otherwise. You've got to have three revenue-increasing ballot issues. People get confused. It doesn't take much to confuse us anyway when it comes to ballot propositions. You know, I don't know what language they're written in. I just only know what language I vote in, and it doesn't make sense. But I think as long as they're competing like that, they're looking for trouble. And if I were the Howard Jarvis folks, I would just say, keep going. Sort of like Obama saying to the Republicans right now. The other thing is that anybody should not get too excited about this, because the rule of thumb when you're looking at money-related initiatives particularly is that if you're not going into that race, into that election with 60%, you're likely to be toast. Why is that? Because at the end people say, well, you know, maybe not. You know, I was thinking about it, but no, not so much anymore. And there's this big drop-off. So at 63, at 60, 58, not so good. You know, I know a lot of people are celebrating, but I wouldn't be taking that money to the bank, not yet. One more thing, we know this much, as the economy improves in this state, and it is improving slowly, 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 we know that people tend to be a bit more generous with their wallets. So we've got some conflicting things going on here.
On the other hand, we could have a big bump in revenue when people will say, why do we need to raise taxes? You know, I agree with what Larry was talking about. There were polls last year that showed that people would vote for the Jerry Brown tax proposal that he wanted to put on the ballot before. And the problem with those polls is that when voters had a chance to vote on those proposals, in California they rejected them 2-1. So the thing you really have to worry about for this is that people say that they're going to vote for something, but it's always easier to vote no. And I just want to say one other thing about the millionaire's tax hike. Now, I don't make $1 million a year. I work for a nonprofit, the San Francisco Chronicle. but this is a really bad policy idea, because it makes one of the problems with California. We have a very progressive income tax, which is fine. I'm for that. But it means that when the economy is going gangbusters, we get tons of extra money in. And when it sinks, it just goes down like this. You want to have a revenue stream that you can sort of rely on and predict, and so that you don't have the salad days, and then you're starving, and then back and forth and back and forth. And it's just a bad policy thing. And I think that it wouldn't take a lot to talk to people about it. And by the way, you get 100 millionaires to move out of the state, there goes a lot of revenue. So I just, doesn't affect me personally, except I live in this state and I want to see it do well.
Yeah,
could I add one point, sure, please? Actually, this thing is getting worse, not better. The economy may be improving, but the revenue collection is sinking. John Chung, the controller, really does some great work, and every month he puts out a report. Okay, how much money did we really take in? Not how much everybody's forecasting. How much did we get? What can you count? What can you see? Okay, how much did we spend? Okay, and we've got a $5 billion gap right now. We've got a projected a $5 billion gap beyond the gap that we had at the beginning of September. So since this fiscal year started, our revenue gap has grown by $5 billion more. So we're looking at not just a $9 billion gap that Jerry Brown says we're going to have effective July 1st, or the $13 billion gap that the Legislative Analyst Office says. Add $5 billion to that. Welcome to the new fiscal year. You know, it's another disaster about to hit us. And frankly, I just don't know if there's any more to take from anywhere.
Do you think he'll get any help from his lieutenant governor, Gavin Newsom? This is a softball question, as you'll see in a moment.
Well, if you should read the Chronicle editorial page today, because Gavin Newsom came in for an ed board yesterday. And I think
a meeting with your editorial board.
An editorial board meeting, that's correct. And I think he's a little bored with the job. And so he was talking about how he believes that it shouldn't be a separate office, that the governor and lieutenant governor should be bracketed and run together. So I said, well, what does the governor's office have to say about this? And he said, well, they haven't really responded. That's not a good sign for working together. We'll leave it at that.
They didn't have his phone number.
We were talking about this earlier. We absolutely should bracket the two together. And in fact, as we do with the presidency, the gubernatorial nominee should be able to basically choose his lieutenant governor. You know, no differently than the president and the vice president. They have to work together if you're going to have both of them. Frankly, I'm not even sure we need a lieutenant governor and all of the wonderful ribbons that he cuts. But that's another story. But yeah, he's in no man's land.
It's a one-party state. You don't need to have a bracketed lieutenant governor.
I'm okay with that.
You know? But I do think people will wonder, do we need one if this discussion continues? I think Larry's right.
Well, staying on California just for a little bit, again, in a San Francisco Chronicle story this week, we learned from a poll, or about a poll from the Public Policy Polling Organization, that California is the least favorite state in the union. The poll asked people across the United States for their impressions of each state. Only 27% had a favorable opinion of the Golden State. 44% had an unfavorable opinion of our state. Now, not to pick on Mississippi, but we were below that state. And every other state, there are 50 of them, I hear. So what does this say about California, and what does it say about Americans' attitudes toward us?
This
Larry.
Has been a very sad time. I just finished this book, and it's perfect. I mean, that's what I've been doing the last two or three years. It's not so golden after all. It isn't. And if you look at where we spend our money, you know, 48th in education, 50th in transportation, 50th in libraries. I mean, go down the categories one after another. This is a lean state, so much to the lean, it's not even funny anymore. It's just not good. It's not healthy. We're throwing away the next generation in terms of our kids. We're throwing them all under the bus. And, you know, you can have this conversation with somebody, and they're nodding, you know, like a bobble doll. Yeah. And then you throw in this, we need to raise more revenues. Okay? And people don't connect the two. What does it take? Do I have to draw something? You know, the two go together, and it really saddens me that we've come to this point. I think there are ways we can resolve it, by the way, without taking more money from income taxes. I think you're dead on, in that we have to find a way to diversify our revenue collections. Lots of ways to do it, but so far we're going nowhere, and it's sad.
I'm looking at the bright side. We're twice as popular as Congress.
There you go.
Yes. Well, I want to quickly remind everyone you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guests today are Dr. Larry Gersten, Deborah Saunders, and Michael Fox. Now, we're going to move on to some questions from you on the floor if you want to come up to our microphone there. I'm actually going to start off by, if we get anyone up there, you're welcome to, but I'm going to start off by trying to synthesize a few questions that we've had that have tried to talk about foreign policy issues, how that's going to affect our campaign. Is this presidential campaign, for example, all about economics and contraceptives, or...
And aspirin.
Or is, I mean, very serious stuff going on in Iran. I mean, do those have... Is that likely to be a judgment on, for example, the current administration? Or is this, like I said, all about economics?
I don't think so. Look, foreign policy is always an issue. It probably will be a good one for Obama, if for no other reason, because he'll remind everybody that Osama bin Laden is gone and all that stuff, and all the terrorist leaders that have been done in by drones and stuff like that. I don't think so. I think it's the economy. I mean, I think it's like we've heard before, jobs. And what people are going to be looking at is, are things looking better? Okay? we look to see where we're going, you know, and they don't want, we don't have to be there. But if there's that upward trajectory, I think it's going to help the Democrats. If things flatten out and, you know, this thing just sort of like spins and goes nowhere, unemployment stays at 8.3, 8.4, something like that, I think he's in some trouble because Republicans will say, he's had 4 years, what has he done? And never mind, you know, how deep this thing was and all the other stuff. He's had 4 years. What has he done? So that's sort of my take.
Yeah, I would just say if Iran blows up the Strait of Hormuz or Israel does something in Iran, that will definitely have an effect on it.
Yeah. Because of the majorness of the issue, to use a great word, or because that will have an economic effect through oil and stuff like that?
Both.
Yeah. Okay. It'll be a scary world.
Yeah.
Not that it's
not scary at the moment.
Okay, well, if we haven't scared you enough, we have a question from the floor, please.
Could you explain how we went from jobs to the deficit is the most important issue? And could you also please explain some of the Republicans' economic programs, but I don't hear anybody in the press really asking good questions about those.
Okay, so our...
Well, I mean, that's sort of one of the problems that the Obama administration has been juggling when it looks at what it wants to do with the budget. Does it go to try to create jobs, or does it go to work to reduce the deficit? By the way, Mitt Romney even said the other day, well, if you really try to reduce the deficit and government spending too much, it could hurt the economy. So he actually addressed that. But I think a lot of conservatives believe that the larger this deficit gets, the more of a problem our American economy is going to be, that our ratio of debt to GDP is so high that you can't really get the economy going unless you show, if not a commitment to do something this year, at least a commitment to address entitlement spending and the growing debt problems that come from that in the future. So I hope I've answered your question.
Go ahead.
The deficit's a serious issue. Jobs are, too. I mean, I think that's part of the Economic Recovery Act was all about, you know, finding a way to get people employed. And I think it has done that on some level. But Deborah's right. I mean, you know, we've got to address this deficit. And what I find incredibly disappointing was the question that I believe it was John King asked, and perhaps it was the very first, Wolf Blitzer, one of the very first debate, you know, how many of you would favor, you know where I'm going, how many of you would favor $5?
10 to 1.
Yeah, it got to that. Yeah, well, I was building up. Okay.
Sorry.
Doggone.
I was wrong.
Took by a line, yeah. He went as high as 10 to 1. Would you take $10 in cuts for every $1 in tax? No. And so you get to a point where as long as we sort of have that kind of problem, nothing's going to get repaired because you're going to have a mixture, admittedly more cuts than spending, okay? But you're going to have to have it. So all there is to it.
Very good. Yes, sir.
Yes. It appears that of the Republican candidates, John Huntsman is the only one who believes in global science and evolution and just a few other things that 99% of Europeans believe in. The question is there any chance for him to come to the fore? And eventually, the impacts of global science or climate change are going to be big time, and it's going to be interesting to see which of the two parties jump on that first.
John Huntsman dropped out of the race. He endorsed Mitt Romney. So.
Which he'll have a vote at the convention. That's it. There's no leader Republican right now that's really worked up over global warming. Newt Gingrich was at one point. He joined the flip-flop club.
He sat on the couch with Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, I know.
That's right.
No.
Speaking of climate change, there has been quite a brouhaha, this past week or the past 2 weeks? Some of you might be familiar with the ClimateGate scandal of a few years ago when some internal documents were released that showed some disagreements among scientists in, I think, the U.K.
East Anglia University.
East Anglia. What can you tell us about what happened recently with an organization called the Heartland Institute?
So this issue has moved here to Oakland because there's a group, the Pacific Institute, and one of the co-founder, Peter Glick, came out and admitted that he lied, used someone else's identity to get material that he could use to discredit a group called the Heartland Institute, which is skeptical on global warming. And this is just a bad admission because he was on the AGW, I forget what exactly what that stands for, geophysicist, their ethics task force. If you go on his Forbes website, he says he really talks about the integrity of science a lot. And this is global warmer side, they're thinking, ha-ha, when the 2009 East Anglia emails got leaked, they were always complaining about, don't you think this leak is wrong? And all the people who were skeptics were laughing, saying, ha-ha, no, it isn't. Now the Heartland Institute is rather upset that it has had its stuff leaked. So there's some, but this did set back the global warming movement, because when you have somebody who's a scientist who says, hey, I will actually lie in order to promote my cause, it hurts the credibility.
Agreed.
Okay. Do you have a question? Please, sir. Then.
Thank you. I'd like to go back to the previous lady's question about the fiscal questions and what we're trying to do about it. And it appears to me that the Obama administration is taking a lead in this debate in suggesting solutions that we might have in order to solve it, which focuses much more on a upper level redistribution of income rather than coming to grips with the real problems. My question is it realistic to hope that we could in fact have a true national debate as a part of the presidential contest on these essential issues of the fiscal problem, of the imbalance in the budget, and the question of redistribution, entitlement programs, all of those very, very touchy issues, but that go to the very core of our problem and our challenge as a country?
It's a great question. Do we actually get good debate on this stuff, or has it all become sloganeering too?
Once we have a nominee, the debate moves to, one of the problems with this primary and the number of debates is it's a bunch of people talking to each other who, all agree that this carpet is blue. It's just how blue is it?
It's severely blue.
It's severely blue. That's great. There is actually a middle ground. On the left, you hear people saying we have to tax the rich and then we'll take care of the deficit that way. Well, there aren't enough rich people. And on the right, you hear that we have to go after the deficit. My disappointment in President Obama, and it is severe, is that he could find a way where he could work on deficit reduction, and he's not at all. But he could reform taxes, make them flatter, and that is something where he could get the left and the right together. But he's decided he doesn't want to do that. And that is a problem for this country. He's just decided he's going to try to make the other side look bad. Instead of trying to come up with something that really people could agree on, he just keeps acting as if he can take care of the deficit on the backs of the rich. I wish there were that many rich people.
Larry?
Well, the devil's in the details in all these things, of course. And as they say, we often only know what we read. But there was talk some months ago about Obama and Boehner coming to terms with a $4 trillion deal. A $4 trillion deal. I don't think that means he's sitting on his, hind end here. I mean, I think they had come to terms with it. And from what I gather, the biggest problem is the Speaker not being able to control, a big part of his party, And
Larry, there was $800 billion in tax hikes, and before the deal was cut, the White House added $400 billion more. Now, that's what I would call a poison pill where you're trying to kill a deal.
Well, that's where you get to different opinions about what the facts were, okay? Not everybody has said that, and I don't know. I wasn't in the room, okay? But I think Obama's proposal the other day about restructuring not only income taxes but corporate taxes, I think the president's making proposals. How serious he is, I can't answer that. I do think, to your question about the entitlements, look, the three biggies are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. I'm sorry, we can solve Social Security in about 30 seconds. About 30 seconds.
We could do it. We could do it right now.
We sure could.
I'll give you 30 seconds.
All you got to do is raise the age, because when Social Security was passed, the Social Security Act in 1935, you started collecting at 65. You know what? Nobody lived to 65. What a great system. Okay. Well, you're not 65. You're getting another job if you're lucky.
Add some means testing.
Right. Add some means testing. Kick it up to 70. Stuff like that, and you can even raise the income level from 110,000 to higher up. That's fine. It's a redistribution program. Medicare, that gets dicey. Now you've got different answers to it, but still, there needs to be a serious conversation on that and Medicaid. And we're going to have no choice. These are all going crazy, and the directions are very, very scary. We have to deal with it. We can't wait till the last minute. My guess is we won't see anything serious about this until 2013.
Let's get in one more question before we bring up Michael Fox.
Now that you have actually talked about some of the real issues, what about the non-issue that keeps coming up, the whole business of reproductive rights and contraception and heartbeaters and personhooders? What amount of difference do you think that's going to be in the long run?
Well, is that primary fodder, or do you think that will actually show
up? I think it's
going
to have to be primary fodder, because it's the kiss of death for the Republicans if they pursue this thinking down the road. It's just, I mean, this is not just, I've heard it, it's a religious issue. No. It's a woman's issue, and for that reason, it affects a lot more than just religion. You will see this go away. You will see this go away after the convention. Because remember, right now, no, she says no. Okay, that's good. Right now, you know, they're all fighting over this very fairly right-wing activist block of voters who love what they hear. But you've got to turn on a dime after the nominating convention. And everyone's got to hightail to the center. And when they do, wedge issues like that, you know, better be real powerful. Otherwise, they're going to sink you. But now she'll tell you.
Well, I mean, let's remember what brought this up, which is that the Obama administration decided that Catholic institutions would have to provide access, which means free, birth control through not just the churches would be exempt, but the hospitals and the other institutions wouldn't be. Now, I think every woman in America has access to birth control. The question is, where do you get it? It was provocative, but good politics, for the administration to come out of the blue and do something that had never happened before and say to religious institutions, even though this is against everything that you believe in, you're going to have to pay for this. Tons of lefty Catholics, and we know that there are lots of lefty Catholics, they were appalled that the administration did it. Now, it was great politics, because they're going to spend through November trying to tell women that the Republican Party wants to get into their bedroom and keep them from getting contraception Rick Santorum aside and some of the ill-considered and amazing remarks he's made on contraception, the Republican Party doesn't want to take away anybody's ability to go to a doctor and get birth control. It's really whether or not you're going to make a church pay for it. The optics work for the Democrats on this in the long run. There are polls that show that Americans think that the Obama administration overreached. You watch, it's going to change. It's a good issue for them. But it isn't really the issue that people think it is, I think.
I think we could, and we probably will be talking about this again throughout the campaign, but we do have to wrap this part of our show up. Deborah has to leave us. And at this time, we're also going to welcome Michael Fox to our stage. Thank you, Deborah.
Look away. I burned your eyes. Supposed to leave us.
Yes. Thanks a lot. Michael Fox is a veteran Bay Area film critic and journalist. He's written for Variety, San Francisco Magazine. He's appeared on KQED, many, many places. Welcome to Week to Week.
Thank you. Now that my blood pressure is elevated.
Yes. So, the Academy Awards and women's reproductive... No. actually, the Academy Awards, they're kind of like they've become the Super Bowl institution where all this attention gets focused on usually a very small group of really huge films every year. And I know you have got a particular interest in pointing people to films they don't necessarily get to see that much of. So mostly we're going to be hearing about over these next 2 days the films that are up for the Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Actress roles. What are some of the categories you watch? What do you find the most interesting?
I warned John that I have a very bad attitude about the Oscars, and he said, it's okay, come on, anyhow.
Yeah.
So I sort of forewarn you. Because it's more about commerce than art. Can I use the word art with respect to movies, which everyone considers the most populist medium? And certainly on the telecast, at least half the presenters will use the word art. Hopefully I can be less pretentious about it. I should point out that the telecast is one of the reasons that California rates so low in the favorability, because that's how California is represented to most of the country. But the categories, as John suggested, that I tend to focus on are documentary, foreign language film, and the screenwriting categories, perverse as that may be. Frankly, I don't think very much good comes out of Hollywood, and it doesn't even get overlooked by the Academy Awards. It just isn't produced in Hollywood. Part of the problem is that the studios, although always profit-oriented, are owned by multinational companies. Multinational corporations, their concern is revenue streams. And there was a time, even 20 years ago, I would say, when studios made films that were intended to make a lot of money and films that were meant to be prestigious and get awards, so that when the studio execs went out to lunch, they could not look like complete sellouts, shall we say, that they had some integrity. I don't think that even matters to them anymore.
We did see over the last, decade and a half, kind of the Miramax, the Sony Classics. I mean, wasn't that an attempt to try to get that market, or were they just kind of shoving films in there so they had another brand?
Well, those independent distributors existed and then were acquired by the studios. The same way that Budweiser... do they still do a microbrew? I saw a commercial once for a microbrew. It's like you can't even leave that part of the market alone for a small company. You had to buy that niche too. So that was their essentially their Academy Award branch, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an old story, but I don't know that it's any different now. Some years ago, studios were complaining about how expensive movies were, and a script would come in that could be made for a low price. And they would throw it at a star. And, of course, then the whole budget increases dramatically, not just because of the star salary, but everything else around it. Now you don't have an inexpensive movie anymore. So they're sort of genetically incapable of making small movies.
Are there any small movies besides the... Well, it might be unfair for me to lump in foreign and independent films, but in my mind they always are, because as a moviegoer, that's kind of my chance to see something I might not see elsewhere. You know, actors I've never seen before, stories, pacing... that I'm not familiar with, but are there independent films that have made it onto that list this year of nominees?
Well, there are a couple, and there are a couple that haven't. Okay. Every year there seems to be one. Last year the film was Winter's Bone, or maybe that's 2 years ago. I remember a film called Winter's Bone, and Frozen River, was that the one with Melissa Leo? So there's always one that sort of jumps out. This year there isn't really one on the list. The one that got a lot of respect but is perhaps more of a genre film and therefore wasn't going to get Oscar consideration was Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, which maybe allows me to segue to something, John, which gets me into writing a little bit, which is the reason I like that particular film is that it's cinematic, is that things are communicated and the audience's participation is encouraged by the way the story is told visually, not through dialogue. So, for example, if we look at the screenplay nominees, for example. Leaving out Woody Allen, if I may, and I know many of you loved Midnight in Paris, but I think he should be embarrassed compared to work he did 20 years ago. The movie doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have characters, but other than that, it's fine.
It's got stars.
actually, Margin Call is the one with stars. Margin Call is the basic financial crisis film, which consists of two, three, or four people in a room talking, scene after scene. Well, sometimes they talk on a fire escape atop the building. But it's delivered by stars. The dialogue is read by stars, so that puts it over. The dialogue's fine. But it's all dialogue. There's nothing cinematic going on. So that's sort of what I'm getting at is the cinematics of it. And here, can I rant a bit longer here?
Please.
Because it does tie into writing. The film that I enjoyed the most this year and thought was most successful, which is nominated in the adapted screenplay category as well as best actor, is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And if you pay close attention to that film, well, you have to pay close attention to that film. But there's a lot of exposition that's communicated in the form of dialogue on the soundtrack while something else is happening on screen, i.e. a car is driving somebody from here to here. And then there's something being said on the soundtrack. So I appreciate they had to compress a very large and complex novel. But the way they did it is there's basically no wasted time. Every bit of visual is an excuse to also communicate something about the characters, about the plot, about what's going on somewhere else while we're here. So without quick cutting, which is sort of the contemporary way of trying to convey things of compressing time. Mm-hmm.
I think, what was it, back in the early 80s, I think a lot of people who do not at all follow smaller or independent films, their first exposure to it was probably one of the better services that Ebert and Siskel did, mm-hmm. which was highlighting My Dinner with Andre, which was two people talking, right? Is anyone doing that job today on a national level?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have a really good answer for that, John, but I'll give an upbeat answer nonetheless, which is that...
You're supposed to have the bad attitude.
I am. And especially as a critic, what I'm going to say is that the amount of good writing on the Internet about film is that's available to any of us is astonishing. And I'm not talking about professional critics, per se.
Really?
You can seek out, if there's a film you saw, a foreign film, or Tinker Tailor or anything else, you could find very literate writing and analysis of that film. They may be hobbyists, okay? They may be obsessives. But they're you know, way more knowledgeable about the intricacies, let's say, of Kirsten Dunst's career than I will be in terms of their writing about Melancholia, for example. So you can really, if you're just a little bit proactive, you can find really wonderful, provocative writing. Now, that doesn't help if you don't already know the film, because what you're talking about is can something be brought to someone's attention without the big ad campaign. I just think you have to be proactive. I think you always had to be proactive, unless you lived near a theater, an art house, where you'd walk by and see a marquee. I think you always have to be proactive. And I guess I don't know about this audience, but I'm speaking into a world where fewer people open up a Friday paper and see the full-page ads for what's opening today. There's other ways that people find out what's playing or what's coming.
Okay. You've got a list of the Oscar nominations in your hand, I believe. And you did promise
to
bring your bad attitude. So which movie are you going to be the most sick of hearing about by the time this weekend is over? Because then we're going to, of course, get the newspaper ads where they're telling us how many awards they won.
Another rant coming. I'll circle around to that question, if I may. Because I suppose the artist would be the one, because that's the one that's probably going to win most of the important awards. And I have no problem particularly with the artist, but any movie that gets overpraised or wins by acclamation or somehow is sainted by acclamation, I tend to recoil from. What I'm going to rant about more so is the number of Best Picture nominees. You know, for a long time, it was five. There was a time historically when there were 10. The 30s and 40s, I think, there were 10. The pre-TV age, when Hollywood produced enormous numbers of movies for all audiences, and everybody went to the movies, right? And so they made high art and low art and star pictures and, you know, B and C movie programmers. Mm-hmm. The studios don't make that many movies anymore. So how come we're expanding the number of Best Picture nominations? Well, it expands the number of movies that can put in their ads nominated for Best Picture of the Year. So for me, it's not about acknowledging the best and calling attention to the best. It's about selling more tickets. Which is to say there's some films in this list of nine. They're actually nine. You're not required to have 10. It's so arcane that I can't even begin to understand, let alone explain how they arrive at it. But there's some titles that really just don't deserve to be listed as Best Picture of the Year. And if there were only five nominees, they wouldn't be among them. So I think I'm a little tired of The Descendants. How about that?
I liked it.
I was going to say, you're tired of George Clooney, or you're tired of that
movie?
Well,
I think George Clooney gives a good performance considering he's so miscast in it.
Really?
Okay.
That's what I liked about it. He was so un-George Clooney.
But, you know, I understand the movies are about suspending disbelief. I recognize that. But we really have to... I hurt myself trying to pretend that George Clooney was a guy who would be cuckolded and then, you know, 10 minutes later not have it solved, if you know what I'm trying to say in a polite way for broadcast. It should be a schlump or a schlub should be playing that part, right? It shouldn't be a good-looking guy who they put on 5 pounds for the role.
Probably cuckolding someone else's.
Well, there, that's good, too.
Okay. Well, before we wrap up this...
Where do you go from there?
Well, tell us maybe a couple of your films that are not going to be highlighted in the Academy Awards that you'd like us to be able to leave and want to go and look it up on DVD or find out if it's playing around here.
Well, there was a film called The Mill and the Cross, which is reflected nowhere here, which actually had a pretty good theatrical run in this city and major cities. Why is that surprising? Because it's a film about a Bruegel painting. They imagine the backstories of the characters painted into this painting. So, and it's an amazing use, actually, of computer graphics without calling attention to it in the same way. I don't know that it would work for you on the small screen, but that's what I would suggest. You know, it's funny, I didn't really bring a list of the overlooked movies of the year.
I thought that's what you really wanted to make sure we...
I know.
We got our benediction here and went
yeah,
forth to.
Yeah. I apologize.
That's okay.
Drop the ball.
Well, now I'm going to turn some questions on you folks. We want to do a news quiz as we wrap up here. And I'm going to ask some questions. If you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll point at you and just shout it out. So question number one. We'll start locally. San Francisco's assessor recently reported that a majority of the foreclosures in the city involving, you know, private home mortgages had at least one, quote, clear violation of the law, unquote. What percentage of them had these errors? Does anyone know? Sir? Nope. Very close. It was actually 84%. So, yeah, my hint was going to be that it's a lot. Question number two. San Francisco leaders recently downgraded their expectations of the economic benefit the city would be getting from a major sporting event that's going to be held in 2 years' time. That's right, the America's Cup. They're now saying it's not going to bring as much money as they had.
And it's going to cost more.
Yes.
That's the way we work in California.
I don't know why the rest of the country doesn't love us. Question number three. Facebook and Google. They might not like each other. They certainly don't play together nicely and share toys. But they have both been the subject of the same complaints over the past couple of weeks. Complaints that have them both facing lawsuits and even threats of legislation, in fact, around the world in some cases. So what is the general focus of these complaints?
In the back.
In fact, Google is being criticized for changing its privacy policies, and Facebook is facing lawsuits over claims that it tracks users even when they're not logged into the social networking site. So question number three, speaking of tracking people even when they're not with you, the New York City Police Force has been accused of doing what to terrorism suspects? Sorry? That's right. Even when they're outside of the state, and in fact, they followed them on Facebook. So. Life's circle of life, I guess. Question number four. The United Nations Nuclear Agency issued a confidential report, which, of course, was immediately reported, about Iran's nuclear program. Can anyone tell me what the conclusion was that is upsetting people right now? I'll give you a hint. This will not ease Iran's relations with Israel or with neighbors in the Middle East. In the back. No.
Yeah,
it's true. The UN International Atomic Energy Agency reported that Iran has rapidly speeded up its production of higher-grade enriched uranium, and that Iran had, quote, not given convincing explanations for some missing uranium metal, which they say can be used for nuclear missile experiments. So final question. I'll be very interested to see if anyone knows this one. The obituary for Josie Anello, who died at the age of 93 in Florida, recently became an internet sensation. Why? My hint is that, yes. In fact, the quote is, "She is survived by her son, AJ, who loved and cared for her, daughter Ninfa, who betrayed her trust, and son Peter, who broke her heart."
Wow.
The children had an ongoing feud about family money. Needless to say, loving son AJ wrote and placed the ad. Well, thank you so much, everybody who's joined us for this first program. Our thanks to Deborah Saunders, Dr. Larry Gersten, and Michael Fox. And thanks to everyone here and online. MP3 audio files of today's program are going to be available immediately this afternoon at store.commonwealthclub.org. And be sure to join us here again Friday, March 16th, for the next edition of Week to Week. This program's over. Have a great weekend, everybody.